a number of people, including myself, over the years would ask him, Geshe-la, someone should write this story down. And he'd always say, no, it's not important, it's not important. I mean, we all thought it was important, but we weren't going to argue with him either, of course. So that went on, off and on, over the years. And I remember correctly, I just finished my prelim exams for the PhD before I started the actual dissertating, though that's not really a verb, I know, but it shouldn't be. So we had dinner at his house. It was my wife and I had dinner at the house, and she actually started to ask him questions about what it was like in Tibet before, you know, before they left. And I mean, I had asked him things, and he always kind of had deferred, but for some reason or another, he thought the question coming from someone other than one of his students, he, for whatever reason, he decided to answer. And so he went on this long story about, what was it? I think it was about the Sara War between, you know, when the Tibetan government and Sara were at odds in, what was that, 47, thereabouts? And anyway, he went on in great detail and in a really compelling way. I mean, it was a great story. And I just sat there dumbfounded. And I said, Geshe-la, I've been asking you for years and you never told me anything. And he said, well, I don't know. I just, it seemed like the time to tell the story. So he did that, and of course, after that, I bugged him again to, you know, not to tell it to me. In fact, that was never my idea. I just had the idea that, and many people did, that it should be written down. And he said, no, that's not important now. So, a few years later, I was back in Madison for something. I don't remember what. And I did my occasional obligatory request and said, you know, Geshe-la, this is, you know, get a little more tea. He had retired by that time. And I said, you know, this is the time to write these things down. And, you know, I'm sure people would love to help you with it. And he said, okay, you do it. So came a instant and not unwilling, but unexpected biographer. And so we decided to do it, and then I sought, you know, a way to publish this and sought advice from people because I had never done anything like this. I was, you know, wallowing around in Buddhist philosophy as we all did, and I didn't know anything about biography, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't prepared for such a project, but he chose me, so I said I certainly wasn't going to turn that down. It was a great honor. I was very pleased, though a little terrified, to be the one. So we worked out some details, and then I think the following summer, went back to Madison. I was already living in Arizona at that point, and I just went back in the summer, and we hung out. We stayed in Madison, I think, 2 or 3 weeks, and I just went out and sat with him, and initially I didn't know how it was going to go because he had never been all that forthcoming with these stories, so I was prepared with a barrage of questions, and I had a long list, and I had ideas about how to approach it. But once he got going, it just went. I mean, it was far better than I ever anticipated it would be. It was just, you know, beautifully, I just had to get him started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, talk more about the process for creating the book.
Okay. So, you know, as I said, initially I was there prepared with questions, and it took a little nudging to get him going, because he wanted to do it, but he wasn't enthusiastic about it because he's just too humble and too self-deferential, and he didn't really think that was, you know, what needed to be done. But because he had agreed to do it, he decided he'd do it. So I'd show up with all these questions, and after I think maybe the first 2 days, that maybe the third day or so, I got there at the house, and he said, oh, I did my homework. And he had written down a long list of things that he wanted to tell me. And so he started taking notes for himself. And after that, I didn't really have to do much of anything but show up, ask, you know, and he would talk. And then I would ask maybe clarifying questions if I didn't understand something. And we did that for several weeks that first summer. And I think it's been a long process now. I've actually lost count of how many years it's been. But over the course of many summers, and I think a spring break or two, I went back and just did the same thing again and again. And It didn't really unfold. It unfolded roughly chronologically. I mean, he started at the beginning, but then, you know, 2 years later, he would circle back and say, "Oh, I remember there was this other thing when I was a child," and so he would continue with that. So the process was, he just said whatever he wanted, and I played the inquisitive student, as I am, was, and he would fill in these things, and then I took all the pieces and wove them into a narrative, into a chronological story. And then after we had a pretty well-established rough chronology, I went back and then I read the whole thing to him. And I did that, I think, three times or maybe even four. So I'd go back and then... And that to me was the best part of all, because I was reading him his story. And he was just sitting there on the edge of his seat, very intrigued, and as if he had never heard it before. And then he'd say, "Oh, I think that's pretty good. What do you think?" I said, "Yeah, I think it's great, Geshe-la. Do you think it'll be interesting?" "Yeah, it's interesting. It's very interesting. People will love it." And he would laugh. And was that to me, that was the most heartwarming part of it, is that he was pleased with what we had done. So we did that a number of times up through, what was it, last summer? I don't know. I honestly, I've forgotten about the. It's gone far longer than any of us anticipated, because he wanted it to be complete and he didn't want to leave anything out, and he wanted to make sure that everything was accounted for. And I was happy to listen to, you know, however long it took, because it was great for me.
So, did you record? Were you like recording and then listening back and creating transcripts and then editing it into pieces? Is that the process of putting the story together? I'm curious about that.
Exactly. I recorded everything. And I took notes as I was going, and then at least those, when I was there in the summer and that was all I was doing, I would get home in the evening and then go back over I would listen to the tapes and I would try to just do a rough transcription, and that would invariably generate more questions, which I would bring to him the next day. And we did it that way for those, you know, bigger chunks of time over the summers. And then after that, once we had a text, when I read it to him, I would record again, so that anything he added, I could then integrate or correct or do whatever he said needed to be done. So, yeah, everything was passed through many, 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 many times.
And did you end up doing any kind of fact-checking or helping out with some of the details, or was his memory of the details just spot on and, you know, he didn't have to go back and you didn't have to go check what year it was, or how was that?
Yeah, I did kind of for my own benefit, because, you know, because I got a PhD in Buddhist studies and they make me check details on everything, right? I mean, I have to have footnotes for everything. So I mean, I had read the various Tibetan histories that are around and I had checked against other things, because there were times where he would say, you know, "I don't remember if this happened before that or that happened before this." And he would say, "So you check." So then I would look into it. I mean, his knowledge, his memory of things, and maybe this is just something about memory, I mean, I guess we'll all find out eventually, but his memory of the early stuff, I mean, the childhood up through the time at Sarah and the exile, was just astonishing. I mean, the detail from, you know, "On this day we did this, and then in that afternoon we did this, and then this other thing happened." But then the later parts of it, I mean, and this is one of the things that made it drag on longer than either of us expected. Once he got to America, things weren't as memorable, which I can sort of understand. I mean, he had a job and he was being a teacher at a Dharma center, and that it's not the same kind of adventure as the sort of things he went through, in Tibet and in on into the exile. But, I would, for the Tibet part and the exile part, I mean, I had to look up, 'cause he would mention place names, and he wouldn't really know the place names. Or he'd say, "I think it was this," or it was something like that. So there were a lot of cases where I had to do some detective work for Tibetan place names, people's names who I hadn't heard of before, historical things about, you know, what the relative chronology was between Rating Rinpoche's, you know, going into exile or not going into exile. Handing along the regency and this kind of thing. So, I mean, I checked on that, but it all held up. I mean, he remembered the rough way that these things unfolded, and then I just sort of provided the footnote part of it. And I think I honestly don't remember if this made it into the book or not, but I had drawn up a kind of just a table of chronology for my own sake because I couldn't keep all the episodes straight myself. So I did the background stuff. I did the intro. There's a short intro of all of Tibetan history in 10 pages, something ridiculous like that. But I didn't have to do much, honestly. I mean, in terms of the details, he gave me all the raw material. I just had to, I mean, some of the biggest difficulties were when he would, 2 years later, say, oh, that thing I said before, I don't think that's right. I think maybe it's this other thing. So then I would have to go back and correct. There wasn't much of that, really. There was far less than I thought there might be. But that's more or less, that was my piece of it.
The stories from Geshe Sopa's youth are just really charming, and you're right, full of these amazing details. And I was wondering, you know, you said that he had it all, but did you ever have to press him to come up with more material, or was he all, did he have it all ready for you? And also the fact that he really is a great storyteller, it seems, just to be able to remember these vignettes and anecdotes.
You know, in the very beginning, I was kind of egging him on and saying, well, what about this or what about that? And one of the things that I learned fairly quickly was there were some things that I was interested in that he wasn't interested in talking about, which I don't get to decide, so that's fine. But after even just the first few days in that first summer, he was just on a roll. He got into the project. He was excited to sit down. I mean, I'd get there, and he was ready to go, and the tea was there, and his lists. And I'd say, okay, Geshe-la, go. And then he would just start talking, and I recorded everything, I made notes, and then, you know, the next day I would, if there was something that I just didn't catch or I didn't understand as he was doing it, I would ask him and he would clear it up. But, I mean, I've got all the notes around here somewhere, I mean, that he wrote out his list of his teachers and what initiations and where. I was pretty astonished just how good his memory of those things were. And especially, I mean, those childhood stories I was telling other people as it was sort of unfolding, and they, you know, people were just amazed at, you know, the obviously greatly respectful Geshe Sopa, the great Buddhist master, who is really pretty hilarious too when he's going on these stories. I mean, to watch him tell them, and then to watch him when I told them back to him was just a delight. It was hilarious.
His experience is so remarkable, and I think, you know, part of it just has to do with how old he was, particularly going into exile, because he was already mature enough to kind of have responsibilities and perspective. And I was just reading that section about going into exile, which was profoundly moving. And just the way he recounts the story, I got a very strong sense of this kind of profound internal dislocation and shock that the refugees were experiencing. And anyway, I was just wondering if you were surprised by some of these stories, or how did those stories come about? And was Geshe La himself emotional, or had he had some distance as he told those stories? Because they were very moving.
I think the story that as he told it, that I got the most impact from, and I thought had the most impact for him, was not the exile, but when he's talking about leaving Tsang to go to Sera, last time he saw his mother, as he was walking away and they kept turning back and looking back and his mother was standing there, and he wanted to cry and he couldn't because his uncle would not have that, because that would be inauspicious, that would be a bad thing. But I mean, that story was just devastating. And he handled it beautifully, not surprisingly. He was clearly moved by it as well. And I mean, he said, he says that, you know, and I tried not to cry, and then he said, and I never saw her again. I mean, it was incredibly moving and hard-hitting. I mean, the way he told it. And you could tell he felt it, but it was also, you know, a really long time ago. And the title of the book came from something he kept saying. I mean, because he would say, I never knew if this was real or if this was a dream. Was this something, you know, I mean, initially he was using the phrase real dream, and he said, well, no, that's not, what do you call that when you're not sure if you're awake or asleep? And I said, like a waking dream? He said, yeah, that's it. So he kept saying this, that he had this, looking back at it, even now, I mean, even as he was telling me the stories, he didn't. It's like, maybe one day I'll wake up and this was the dream and I'll really be back there. I mean, sometimes it just doesn't, I can't tell which is which. So, you know, even in the beginning, and he came back to this a number of times as well, is, you know, I can't quite believe that any of this could happen, because as I was a child in Tibet, we didn't even know, we heard this name America, we didn't know anything about it. It was this mythical land, which is oddly the inverse of the way we all largely think about Tibet. Or did, but you know, I it's astonishing that I'm here. You know, we're sitting in a rural part of Wisconsin in the United States, and you know, at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century. And he was really, he had that kind of sense of astonishment about it that was really striking. I mean, and he also felt incredibly fortunate. And that it was a good thing, not just for him, but for certainly all of us there in Wisconsin and those of us here in the United States, that this all happened. And, you know, he would occasionally pause and say, you know, how do you explain these things? I mean, you know, and he would just sort of throw up his hands and say, well, you can't know. These things just happened and it must be karma and there's nothing we can say about it, but I'm still amazed by it all the same.
It seems just remarkable how Geshe Zopa became like a tenured professor at University of Wisconsin. I mean, not because he wasn't qualified, but just because of the American university system and it's Wisconsin. And I did find myself, you know, towards the end of the book, kind of wanting to hear more about his experiences of trying to fit into the university system. As you said, he didn't talk about those details as much.
Yeah, I mean, he kept saying, I mean, and there were a number of times when we said, okay, so I think we're done. Do you think we're done? I think we're done. And then I would call him and he'd say, I was thinking, or he had read, I had sent him the transcript that I had, and he had someone there read it to him again after I had done it. And then he'd say, but I was thinking, you know, there's not very much about America in there. And, you know, I was a professor and I went to classes and I did all these things. And I'd say, well, okay, I'll come back and we'll talk about that and we'll get that down. But when it happened, he didn't, you know, maybe because it just wasn't as remarkable. Or maybe we tried on a number of occasions to get more of those stories and to get more of that detail, but he really didn't have it in his head in the way that he had the earlier stuff. And I kept telling him, I said, you know, Geshe, that's fascinating and that is a very big part of your life, but, you know, don't forget how valuable this earlier stuff is, because this story has not been told, at least not in this detail. I mean, there's been other biographies of Geshe's and monks and lamas who have come out of Tibet, but none with quite this much detail, I think, and especially about the monastic education system. I mean, this is just an incredible resource for that information, in addition to just being a great story. I mean, there's, you know, I don't know of other places where a lot of that information could be found before this thing, when it comes out.
It did seem unique. Like, I don't know of any other book quite like it. Did you go around looking for other models or, you know, seeing if there were other stories like this, or, you know, did you realize that, wow, this, what we're doing really is pretty unusual? Yeah. As you were doing it, did that kind of, was that a realization you had?
Yeah, I thought so right away. But I did my homework and I looked around to see what other biographies there were. Geshe Robtun's biography is out. I think it's out of print. I mean, I've read it. I got it somehow or another. And in some ways, that's a parallel story, because they end up traveling together for part of that journey out. And he was at Sarah, and so there's a lot of parallels. But that story had a lot less detail about what it's like going through the curriculum of the Geshe degree. Losang Gyatso's biography I also looked at, because that was, you know, sort of in the ballpark. And I got an awful lot out of both of those stories, and they were very helpful just in terms of thinking about how to put it together. But, you know, I obviously had to put it together the way, in accordance with what I got. But as it kept growing and then got further refined, there was no question in my mind that it was going to be incredibly useful for Dharma students in the West, for academics, for scholars in the West. And even more importantly, and Geshe-la said that, and I mean, I brought it up and he completely agreed that, I mean, every now and then he would say, well, I'm not sure this is that important. Maybe you don't need to tell all these stories. Maybe that's not so big of a deal. And I said, well, you know, Geshe-la, yes, it's important for your students and the people that know you and know the Buddhist tradition in the West. Yes, that's important. In Western scholarship, that's important. But, you know, there's a lot of Tibetans who don't know any of this now either, because your generation is one of the last that fully grew up and was trained and you know, became adults in a Tibet prior to and during the Chinese invasion. And he said, well, yeah, I guess that's kind of important. So, I mean, I hope it's valuable for all those audiences. I really think it will be.
The thing that strikes me about Deer Park is not only is it like a spiritual home for like all us Western Buddhists, but it just the Tibetan community that comes there. I was at the summer at the His Holiness's birthday celebration thing, and just overwhelmed by just the warmth and vitality of the Tibetan community that was there on that day. It was really fun. Sometimes I think we get, as a Westerner, you know, as American, get so locked into this American view that I forget about all the Tibetan Americans who are also benefiting enormously from all of Geshe Zopa's, you know, work establishing Deer Park and building the beautiful temple there and all that.
Yeah, I've often had that feeling too. It's like, hey, guess what? It's actually about them. It's about us too. But, you know, here they are. There's this great community and the things that Geshe Zopa went through, many of these people went through, and here they are, and they're succeeding, and they're making it work, and he's there as the focal point, as the person that holds it all together for both, you know, the Western Dharma community and all of these Tibetans who have somehow or another made it to the exotic land of Wisconsin and are now, you know, living their lives there.
Well, anything else you'd like to add? Am I missing something?
No, I don't think you're missing anything. I'm just really excited that this is, I mean, you know, obviously in one sense to have something done after so many years is just great, but it's not just that. I mean, there's a relief because it's finally done, but I think this book is going to be really important to a lot of people. I mean, I've heard that it's going to be translated into, that there are already plans to translate it into Chinese and to translate it into Tibetan. And I mean, that to me is, all right, don't tell my academic friends this, but that to me is more important than the various academic endeavors that we all engage in writing articles about, you know, the minutiae of Tibetan philosophy. I mean, I still think that's fascinating. I still do that. But this to me is far more important in a bigger way, you know, in a much more accessible, wide, popular way, which I'm just happy to be a part of. You know, I'm really, really pleased and thankful that he sprung that on me all those years ago and said, yeah, you do it. So, and I got to do it.